There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Thursday, January the 2nd. We're looking at the business of New Year's resolutions. We've got a range of motivational experts for you telling us all how to set goals that will really work for your company or your career.
Get those resolutions you know that you are never gonna do, and adopt a more realistic view by committing to things that come easily to you, like eat at least one value meal a week.
Loving all these New Year's resolution songs you've dug up, Brandy Scott. Where did you find them?
Ah, YouTube is a brilliant place. What do you think of that as a sentiment? Forget the stretch goals. Go for something you know you can do, such as this year, I will drink 2 lattes before 10 a.m.
Well, it's specific, it's measurable, it's attainable, so yeah. It qualifies as smart.
Yeah, I'm already on one. Sometimes two. I could push the boat out. Make it 3.
Yeah. It's not going to pass muster, is it?
No. Look, we are looking at the business of resolutions. We are armed with statistics. We are helped by experts. And we've been speaking to everyone from life coaches to gym coaches, basically, to find out what you can do to give you the best possible chance of succeeding this year. Because I have to say, statistically, your chances are not great. Two psychologists in a new paper that's just come out, an American psychologist, that's a publication, Janet Polivy and Peter Herman, say that actually nailing your resolutions first time around is exceptionally rare. Most people will need 5 or 6 attempts, which is why you often make the same New Year's resolution over and over. I know I definitely fall into that category. They reckon 60% of us will end up making the same resolution next year that we did this year.
Let's get some help. Let's get some advice. We've been speaking to a range of experts this morning. First of all, for your corporate life, Jennifer Baxavanis is a sales performance coach at Freshstone Consulting here in Dubai. She's one of the people companies turn to when they've got sales targets to meet in what is, in many industries, a flat, tough, competitive market at the moment. So we asked Jennifer to take us through the steps to boost your corporate performance in 2020. If we're talking to a client, 2020 is a fresh year, fresh start. How do you go about doing it? And this is what Jennifer told us.
It's really easy maybe to sit down and make a list of goals, but where is that all going towards? And I found that the companies that I work with that have a very specific mission of what they're trying to accomplish in their market or with their target customers, from that, they can take that as an umbrella and make mini goals from that. And from those mini goals, ask themselves the next question: what are the actions and what are the resources I need in order to approach and achieve those mini goals? And that becomes a strategy. So the order kind of goes in: what is the overlying mission? What are we trying to achieve? How do we break that down and measure it and then make a strategy to go towards it?
We also asked her about the basic strategies that are working in 2020, specifically when it comes to sales. This is what she told us.
I've kind of made a movement towards the ABC, with the C being a different word, always be connecting. And when the mission is actually based on the customer, a customer focus, it really helps the sales improve. I find that the organizations that I work with that are collectively across all of their teams, marketing teams, sales teams, and operational teams that come together and create what's called now a sales enablement strategy, they actually succeed more because their marketing efforts and their sales efforts are all focusing on the same way to help the customer. So when I say ABC, always be connecting, I really want to say always be helping, but it sounds better with a C, with connecting.
And we do like a good acronym.
We do indeed. Look, we've also been looking at this from the personal point of view. Maria Tanzi is a certified master NLP practitioner and a life coach. So we got her in to say, we know that 44% of us will make a New Year's resolution. And we know that the top 3 will be exercising, losing weight, and eating well. 3 sides, if you like, of the same coin. But what should we be doing to actually make them stick? This is Maria.
My personal view is that take some time first to decide what it is that you want to achieve, but just take some time to plan. Don't just come up with them overnight or on New Year's Eve, and prepare to set them in motion. So if you haven't, if it's January 2nd already and you haven't already decided, then take a few weeks or take a couple of weeks and wait until, I personally wait sometimes until like the third week in January, because for me it's after the Christmas, it's after New Year, and it's when everyone's back in their routine. So sometimes it's actually easier to start before or just after.
Do you know what? What she said about routine is what James Clear in Atomic Habits says. He says basically you need to make these things second nature and as easy to do as possible. Rich and I are just Googling here to find exercise classes that will fit into our particular early morning, late night routine. It's interesting also what Maria says there about starting a little bit later, because I wonder if you do that, if you will actually miss quit day. Because there are loads of organisations that take our data for some of them, like Strava. It's the data from our Fitbits and all of our gadgets that measure our activity. And for Foursquare and CityLab, it's what we stick up on social media. You know, gym selfie, burger selfie. And they all try to calculate what is the day that it's all just going to go to custard. We're all going to fall off the wagon. Foursquare and CityLab, who are the ones that look at social media activity, they look at the amount of people posting about going to the gym and the amount of people posting about eating rubbish. And they do see New Year's Day, gym attendance posts go up 6%. Checking into McDonald's goes down 4.6%. But they wait and see for those two lines to cross on a graph. They reckon that it's February the 9th.
February the 9th.
40 days after right. you set your resolutions, that it is all over. The guys at Strava, who have access to a lot of personal data from what people are doing from their, I say Fitbit, so I don't think it's necessarily one branded device, if you like. But, you know, they're looking at what people are actually doing as opposed to what they just say they're doing. They reckon it's actually sooner. They reckon that it's January the 19th.
Which is not a huge amount of success, is it?
So maybe if you start later, take your time, really think about it. Don't know, will it give you the edge? Not sure.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are discussing the business of New Year's resolutions.
Nobody in the studio is wearing a bright pink leotard and leg warmers in the style of Olivia Newton-John. But we have got in the studio John Britton, who's head coach and general manager at F45 Training in Dubai Motor City. John, good to see you.
Thanks for having me in.
So we're talking about the economics of New Year's resolutions, and you work in the fitness industry, so you know this very, very well. You must see it all the time. 1st and 2nd of January, flood of people coming in, brandishing their credit cards, signing up for a fitness package, and then from the middle of January onwards, you never see them. Is that a myth? Or is that reality?
No, that is very, very real. It happens. And unfortunately, you know, today is a day where social media and all that stuff gives these crazy, unreal expectations. And, you know, people, they come in best of intentions and then sort of they drop off very quickly.
So what's the problem? What are the mistakes that people are making?
Lofty goals. I mean, people, you know, like I said, social media, see some model on there who is super small, and then they go, well, that's what I want. And it's doable, but people want instant gratification nowadays, and it's not a quick game. It takes some time.
Okay, so in terms of the people who do succeed, if 100 people sign up for F45 or another gym today, let's say 90 will fall by the wayside by February, but 10 out of those 100 will stick with it, and by May, June, they're going to be seeing the results. What are the different things that those 10% of people who succeed, what are they doing differently?
You know, it's a big motivational thing. Fitness is not everyone's cup of tea, so you need to have the motivation there to succeed. And a lot of the time that's going to be having that trainer, that coach there that's going to push you the whole way. And actually follow up with you, you know, not just let you stop and fall off and basically just quit what you're doing.
It used to be that it was you would sign up for a gym membership 10, 20 years ago. And Fitness First is probably the biggest gym chain here, but there are others. But 20 years ago, Brandy, when you came here, that's kind of what you did. But now the fitness industry globally in here has moved on. F49, F45 is not a gym as such that you would join. You offer classes, and that's true of things like Crank or Flywheel or SoulCycle as well. We seem to be moving from a location-based fitness regime or fitness industry to a kind of class-based industry. How are those economics working?
You're absolutely right. It's something that's growing worldwide. F45, for example, has now grown over 2,000 studios in just over 4 years. And people want to come in. They want that team training environment where they're not alone, and you know, they have that motivation. The music's cranked up. It's fun, because that's what people are realizing. You know, it can't be something you just come in and do on your own. It's something you want to actually enjoy doing on a daily basis.
And the statistics suggest, actually, that you're more likely to stick with your membership if you are doing things in a group rather than solo. We've always been a bit cynical in the Business Breakfast studio about this drop-off. Everyone signs up in January, and the amount of people who are actually still lifting weights or doing their cardio circuit or whatever it happens to be, February, March, the numbers deplete. Isn't that in the gym's interests a little bit, though? If everyone who signed up at the beginning of the year kept going all year, where would you put them all?
You're absolutely right, and that's in the interest of some gyms. I know there are the big box gyms like you talked about. That is their business model. They want to just have people sign up, and hopefully they don't come, because then they're going to have a packed gym. F45, for example, is not that way. We need people in our classes, because when classes are bigger, there's more energy, there's more people. That's how our business model works, is we want people returning over and over and over again.
Do we just have the January spike here in the UAE, or do we follow, given that our seasons are different, we have a big lull in summer, do we follow a slightly different calendar?
We do. We find that the big one here in the UAE is actually the September spike, where people do tend to leave for the summertime, then they come back in September. And as you know, sort of beach season here is October, November, December. So yeah, September is our big spike as well.
What are you seeing in terms of competition in the market? Because there are many organizations offering class-based fitness as you are at the moment. And indeed, F45 is a franchise-based system. You have the franchise for F45 in Dubai Motor City and one other?
Marina.
And Dubai Marina. But there are other F45s around town who are different companies. So you're not only are you competing against other brands, you're competing against yourself. What kind of downward pressure have you seen on prices in terms of things like class pass and people buying these group vouchers or discounting or 2-for-1 vouchers that we see in other industries such as the restaurant industry?
Things like class pass we are not a part of, because we want people that are committed to what they're doing, and we don't want to bring our price down to a point where we're sort of lessening our product, right? So the industry is definitely it's seen that way, but things like ClassPass, you're only able to go to a certain gym, 2-3 times a month. We want people that are going to show up every day and stick with our program and sort of see the results that way.
But are you seeing downward pressure on prices? I mean, it seems, what's the average cost for a class at F45, or how are you charging?
It's we got a couple different options. You can go ClassPass or class base, and it's 100 per class, or you can do a membership, which ends up working a lot cheaper per class.
Are you seeing downward pressure on prices? Are you seeing people switch and say, okay, yeah, I love my F45, but the guys down the road are doing something similar for 70 dirhams a class, so money talks.
We see it, but it actually hasn't been a huge effect on us, just because our product, we believe, is the top product out there, and people see that and they stick with it.
So what would your three top tips be, John? We know statistically that the three main resolutions that people set are to exercise, lose weight, and eat better. What are your three top tips for actually making a physical difference to yourself in 2020?
My three top tips would be, first, you do need to set a goal, but you can't make it too lofty or unattainable. You need to make it a goal that is real. And it also has to be a goal that, you can set one for next year, but you can also set one for 2 weeks, 1 month away, that sort of thing. The other thing would be just, figure out the diet and actually speak to your coach or trainer. At F45, we're always going to, consult on the diet. We have our 8-week challenges and that sort of thing, which actually provide the diet plan. And then the third thing is just create a habit. And that's the thing is, you know, make it a day part of your daily routine where you're actually putting that in your daily planner and sort of making it a part of your life.
Well, we finish work around 11:30 every morning. So if you could have classes starting around then, that would be absolutely fabulous. John Britton, head coach and general manager, F45 Training Dubai Motor City. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
Starting with the Saudi billionaire Lubna Olian, she is going to be the first head of a major bank in Saudi Arabia. That is because the merger of... First female head of a major bank in Saudi Arabia. That follows the merger of Saudi British Bank and Al Awan Bank. This is her, Lubna Olian, not talking specifically about this banking deal, but about the three major shifts, game-changing shifts in Saudi Arabia that she think are transforming business.
Obviously, technology is the flavor of the month. Every business has technology in it, even the old business. For us here, we are looking in Saudi Arabia how to optimize and energize our businesses through the use of technology. For us, healthcare is one. And in my country here, we see entertainment is an area that is open.
That's Lubna Olian. Now, she's no stranger to high finance. She's been running the Olian business empire for some time now, which has significant investments in financial services. She's has experience on Wall Street as well. Earlier on in her career, she worked for one of the Wall Street banks. So this is very much in her bailiwick. She's been running Al Awan Bank as a very senior director there for 5 years. But in terms of a major bulge bracket Saudi Arabian bank following the merger, to have a woman as the chairperson of that organization, people in Saudi Arabia saying that is significant. So that is why Lubna Olian is my first newsmaker.
And who's your second?
Another billionaire.
Who wants to be?
Warren Buffett. And he's making headlines in the Financial Times this morning for something that he has not done. Here's the headline. Warren Buffett spurned Tiffany as his deal drought continues. The FT says that, you know, LVMH.
I do.
Bought Tiffany a few weeks ago for $16, $17 billion. Well, Warren Buffett got a call to ask.
He didn't put a ring on it.
He did not put a ring on it. Tiffany called him when LVMH was bidding, saying, what about you, Warren? You fancy it? They've offered $16 billion. Are you up for this? He's got previous with Tiffany because just over 10 years ago during the financial crisis, Tiffany, like many luxury goods companies, was struggling. So he bought $250 million worth of bonds at Tiffany. But he's passed at this opportunity. And the FT says this is part of a wider problem that he's facing, that basically he's got too much money and nothing to buy.
That is very much the definition of a high-class problem.
Very much first world. The company, says the FT, Berkshire Hathaway, that's his investment company, has not made a so-called elephant-sized acquisition for 4 years now, since it bought the engineering company Precision Cast Parts in 2015 for $32 billion. He's got $128 billion sitting in cash on the balance sheet at Berkshire Hathaway, and investors are getting a little bit cross. Jim Shanahan is an analyst with Edward Jones, the investment company. And the FT quotes him as saying, investors are becoming frustrated. Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway are flush with liquidity and will be ready when opportunities emerge, but they're not spending any money at the moment. This is Warren himself speaking, not today, in the recent past, about his investment strategy and those elephant-sized deals he so likes.
I don't care what the market price is in terms of what they're worth to us, but generally speaking, people in evaluating mergers and acquisitions look at the premium paid to the market price and decide whether that's a fair price or not. A fair price to us is one that where we think we're going to get our money's worth in terms of future earnings. And I would say that we will generally have more luck with private businesses than public businesses, although Burlington was a public company. Most good companies sell at prices where if we were to pay a 20% premium to market, I would not want to buy them. I mean, if you look at 50 large companies that would sort of fit the elephant category, if you add 20% to that price, I don't want to pay that for the business. There's a few exceptions to that, but not very many.
He said back in February that prices are sky high for businesses possessing decent long-term prospects. And since then, of course, we've had a 25% or so increase in the S&P 500, the main US stock market benchmark. One final comment on this, and this is one of the reasons that investors are unhappy with Warren and Berkshire Hathaway at the moment. He's underperformed the S&P 500 quite significantly this year. Now, Berkshire Hathaway shares have done well. They're up 11%, but with the S&P 500 being up more than 25% this year, his underperformance is significant. And the FT's got a really good chart going back to the 1980s. And most years, I mean, hold up the chart to you, the lines above the line show the years where he's done better than the S&P 500. Most years he does, but this year he has underperformed the benchmark. He's got money sitting on the balance sheet. He didn't buy Tiffany's because he was too expensive, and some investors are getting twitchy.
Right, speaking of twitchy, my newsmaker this morning is a French chef called Marc Virette, who has just lost a court case against the guys at Michelin.
And that's because?
They downgraded his restaurant from 3 to 2 stars in a scandal known in the industry as Cheddargate.
Go on.
Where the Michelin guide, you know, they have the anonymous reviewers who come in and check that everything from your food to your silverware is Michelin standard. They were in his restaurant and they downgraded him to 2 stars, by the way, which is still pretty good going in the Michelin world, because they suggested that he had used cheddar, an English cheese, in one of his signature souffle dishes instead of a mix of 3 French cheeses, most of which I cannot pronounce. He said, non. I did not, and took them to court. He said that it was, I mean, basically traumatic. He said he only found out about the downgrade when he read the latest Michelin star guide. He said it made the kitchen staff cry. It threw him into months-long profound depression. He said, and I quote, "It's worse than the loss of my parents, worse than anything," unquote. So we sued them. He took Michelin to court in France. And at the end of last year, and wanted Michelin to basically let him know how they do everything, how they go in, that he wanted to see the notes from the man who came and had dinner. They wanted to know how they came to all their decisions. These were all trade secrets for Michelin. So Michelin said, no, we're not going to show you that. They called him a narcissistic diva and said he was suffering from pathological egotism.
Okay, gloves are off.
So much fun for all concerned. The chef just wanted to know all of the details about the judging criteria. He only wanted €1, so kind of symbolic damages. Michelin, however, wanted €30,000 in cost and compensation. They were in it sort of properly once they got hauled into the courts. And they were kind of like, come on now. I mean, you've been downgraded from 3 to 2 stars. Basically, we've said that you're only excellent rather than brilliant. You know, it's still pretty good going. He lost. Mr. Verrier, the chef, lost. The court just outside Paris said that he had not produced a single piece of evidence to show any harm to his business. In fact, the opposite. The business is booming. A few days before the hearing, a rival guide named at one of the 10 immortal restaurants of haute cuisine, and apparently bookings have been going through the roof. So they've said it hasn't actually damaged your business at all. In fact, you could probably argue that the publicity may have done you some good.
But he's left court empty-handed.
He has left court empty-handed, but he's made a lot of headlines. And I do wonder just a little bit whether that might have been some of the point.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's get some more insight now on one of our top stories, the stellar performance of oil over the past 12 months. Joining us on the line here to give us some insight is the managing partner of the energy advisory consultancy Gulf Intelligence here in Dubai, Sean Evers.
Happy New Year to you all.
And a happy new year to you as well, Sean. I'm going to ask you to get out your crystal ball and tell us what's going to happen over the next 12 months shortly. But first of all, let's look back over the past 12 months. What has driven the oil price higher by 35% or so over the past 12 months?
I think it would, I mean, there's probably multiple factors, but ultimately I think we moved from a period of cloudy uncertainty around a number of issues to end the sort of the last part of the year with a number of things becoming a lot clearer. And most notably on that would be the U.S.-China trade talks. you know, for most of last year, there was an expectation of resolution, but uncertain that the Chinese and the U.S. would ever get to the point of some sense of coexistence. And we end the year, the last few weeks, with optimism that the U.S.-China trade talks can get on a very positive track, and with that, open up the opportunity for global economic growth. So I think from confusion to clarity as the year progressed in 2019, Brexit itself, you know, the greatest dilemma in Europe, ended the year with the crystal clarity that it was going to happen from a long period of uncertainty. And a number of cases similar to that, I think clarity towards economic growth lifted the oil price.
So what happens next? What happens in 2020? Because my concern is, and generally I want a higher oil price than a lower oil price living here in the Gulf, my concern is, Sean, that the world is awash with oil and those chickens are going to come home to roost, whether it's new supply in Norway, in the North Sea, or here in the Gulf. I'm very concerned about that. How do you see 2020 unfolding?
Well, I think the major pillar to underpin the oil price recovery last year, and one would say over the last recent years, has been the cooperation between the world's major oil producers, most notably OPEC and Russia. And they came together in the end of the year in 2019, a month ago or so in Vienna, and agreed a bigger supply cut than had been expected. And so the willingness of the world's biggest oil producers to continue to very proactively micromanage oil supplies to ensure that oversupply doesn't get away ahead of itself, I think is an important factor to think about in the year ahead. Now, whether this group of OPEC and Russia and a few other smaller oil producers outside OPEC continue this partnership, I think that is the question. They've certainly indicated in recent years the ability to build a solid partnership, but of course there's so many uncertainties of the geopolitics, I think it probably continues to be one of the factors that can disrupt a somewhat smooth start to the global outlook for economic growth. But OPEC and non-OPEC cooperation is key in 2020.
But how long can they maintain this? Because the United States continues to produce more oil. We heard from Halima Croft, energy analyst earlier, one of the most watched energy analysts, saying the story of the decade has been the rise of U.S. oil production. A decade ago, America was producing about 5 million barrels a day. Now it's producing more than 10 million barrels a day. Can OPEC and its mates like Russia just keep on cutting and cutting and cutting to keep the price above $60 a barrel? I'm concerned that they can't. But where do you see oil this time next year, Sean?
Well, I think first addressing the shale, I mean, clearly shale oil production coming out of the U.S. has been the sort of the major player of the last decade, and to a great extent, OPEC and other major oil producers have underestimated the continuous ability of U.S. producers to continue to drive up production, even at lower oil prices. The constant sort of analysis from OPEC and others was, oh, there's no way that the U.S. producers can continue to grow at, you know, $50 oil. But they have, and they're an innovation and their technology is really one to respect. But ultimately, the other challenge with U.S. production is that they have to give a return on investment to their investors. And many of the U.S. producers have a lot of debt, and that is a burden in which they are struggling to deal with. And so there is an expectation this year that finally the shale oil production will sober. It won't decline, but its ability to continue to grow a million and a half barrels every year will be constrained. At least that is the expectation. Now, with regards to the ability of OPEC to continue to cut to keep the price propped up. I think there is a limit to that ability. And now the expectation and the hope is that they won't have to do so because global economic growth with US-China resolving their trade differences has that opportunity to support demand and sort of drive up a greater requirement for more oil. Where's oil prices at the end of 2020? One would hope they're in and around where they are at the moment, somewhere in the 60s. I think we all have to get used that somewhere in the 60s is the new normal. Hopefully that can be sustained. It's not as high as one might like. It's not 70, but it's certainly high enough to give a very significant revenue to regional governments to drive government spending and push regional economic growth forward.
Finally, Sean, what about the existential threat, if you like, to hydrocarbon producers like Saudi Arabia, the UAE and others? The rise of renewable energy, the rise and emergence of Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager who's the Time Person of the Year. Have a listen to this. This is a good friend of yours, the UAE Energy Minister, His Excellency Sahail Al-Mazrui, speaking just a few weeks ago here in Abu Dhabi about the rise of renewable energy. I'm going to ask you to listen to this and then get your thoughts on what this might mean for a hydrocarbon producer like the UAE.
Our UAE energy strategy is calling for 50% contribution from clean forms of energy, which would include renewable energy and nuclear. And you don't see so often a country that is responsible for supplying oil and gas to the world taking such bold strategy.
That is Sahail Al-Mazrui. How big a deal is this?
Well, I think it's obviously significant in the sense that renewables is so economically competitive now for particularly power generation that you'd be foolish not to be doing all you could to get renewable energy, solar, wind, and whatever other mix into your fuel supply because of the cost competitiveness of solar in particular for power generation. So every country in the world that has an ability to do so will be and is increasing renewables. Yes, for climate obligations, and we all need to play our part individually and collectively, but just the simple economic logic, power supply, why would you burn such a precious commodity like oil or gas? Gas obviously is a fuel that is still very much in the power generation game, but oil in particular, it's crazy to be burning anything related to oil to create power, and that's the case everywhere in the world. It's just too precious. Ultimately, Richard, the world needs all energy, all of these that you can get. India, a billion and a half people. China, a billion and a half people. And despite the economic challenges that they all face, Africa, again, going to a billion and a half people. All of these three major demand centers, China, India, and Africa, their population is continuing to grow significantly. And not only is it continuing to grow significantly, but also its economic growth, its middle class is growing significantly. And with that, the demand for every form of energy to continue to support the economic development of three major demand centers. So as long as those are in play, all energy supplies will be in great demand. The challenge
Sean,
we're going to have to make it efficient. That's the challenge of the 20s, efficient consumption.
Great talking to Sean Evers of Gulf Intelligence. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for listening. Richard and I will be back Sunday morning from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.